This is The Takeaway. And you know, what I think we need for the rest of this hour is something like a playful look at the humanity of food. Listen to that. There's a band down in Orlando, Florida, making music with pots and pans. Yep. Stuff from the kitchen. They're called the Groove Chefs. And right here, you've got a different, churchier sound, I'd say. Again, made with pots and pans. Those are two women musician cooks performing on the street in Toronto. Would there be music without cooking? Would there be culture? Would there be civilization without spoons, chopsticks, woks, measuring cups, and skillets? Consider the Utensils. What a terrible title for a book on food history and culture that would be. Much better would be Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. That's the real title of food writer and historian Bea Wilson's new book. Bea Wilson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So there's so much to talk about in this book. There are, in some sense, pot people, pots and pan people, and knife people, right? That's a good place to begin.
There are. I think some of us feel very affectionate about certain utensils, and I know I'm a pot person. Knives, although I can see that in some ways they're the most important utensil, they certainly come first in history. And every chef I've ever met pretty much told me that the knife was their favourite utensil. They scare me. I mean, knives are still instruments of violence at some level, whereas pots are somehow friendly, aren't they? They seem to have personalities almost. I think we all have our favourites that we turn to again and again every night.
And my mother used to say that if you have more knives than you have bowls, you're really not a cook. You're just a slicer.
Ah, that's a good saying. And actually, if you're really skilled with your knife, you only really need one knife anyway. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how, if you look at the difference between French cuisine and Chinese cuisine, French haute cuisine is a cooking based on many, many different knives, from oyster knives to kind of special curved ones for peeling chestnuts with. Whereas a Chinese cook can do absolutely everything, from the most fine kind of parchment thin cutting of ginger to great big hacking of a whole chicken with this one knife, the two. So, yeah, your mum was probably onto something there.
We're talking with Bea Wilson. Her new book is Consider the Fork, The History of How We Cook and Eat. You know, a lot of this book is about measuring and how different cultures measure. And one of the interesting conclusions is that, you know, we may have a lot of instruments for measuring, but we do a lot of eyeballing. We do a lot of, you know, shoot from the hip measuring. And that's a part of our community culture orientation to food.
Yeah, I think no matter what measuring instruments you have in the kitchen, whether it's the old-fashioned American cup measures or whether it's a high-tech digital scale, the best tool for measuring is always going to be the cooks themselves. We use our eyes, we use our sense of smell. We all can know by looking at something, roughly speaking, whether it's done, whether it's going to taste good. And there are all these little signals which are actually much more powerful tools of measuring than any mere object can ever be. And also the human body. I became really fascinated by the way in old cookbooks you'd have people describing sort of that you should chop things as big as a finger. And lots of cooks in Ireland still, when they're making soda bread, will just measure the bread out in handfuls of flour. And it works fine most of the time.
Are the items that you profile in here, are they inventions, strictly speaking? Did someone have to invent a pot, invent a chopstick, invent a fork?
I think some of them are more like communal inventions. I mean, I would describe what's behind any of these objects as maybe intelligence more than invention in some cases. I mean, yes, somebody would have had to have invented the first act of boiling. I mean, that really takes me aback. The thought of what it would have been like to cook before you had pottery. And for me, that's really the invention of cooking in the sort of important sense. And it only happens 10,000 years ago, which I know sounds a long time to us, but in historical terms, it's very, very recent compared to just cooking things directly over the flame. And it would have made things so much better, because the first time, once you've got a pot, you can boil things, you can mix flavours together, you can mingle things, you have the first casseroles. And sure, we don't know who the first person was who made a pot and thought of doing that. It was probably many, many people who made the first experiments and then sort of tried doing this and tried doing that. And yes, we may never know their name, but I still think it counts as an invention.
Well, we should put on the calendar the first casserole, if we could find the date of that. I would love to have that on my calendar.
I would as well.
You know, we were talking earlier with David Pogue about one of the things that makes us human is language, and that language appears to have come from the making of tools. There must be language that comes directly out of cooking.
I think there is. I mean, I think cooking, I mean, it was Richard Wrangham in his amazing book, Catching Fire, who said that cooking is one of the first acts that made us human. It was the crucial stage, probably, in the leap from being a primate to being some sort of humanoid. I think just being able to heat things over fire and then eat them, I mean, it's fundamental to human society. If you think of the way that we've always designed our homes from the earliest time, the focus, I mean, the meaning of the word focus is hearth or fireplace. That's where we want to be, in the kitchen.
You know, you get into the soft-cooked egg controversy in here, and I really, really love that. There's a certain amount of precision. You're very brave. There's a lot of precision that goes into making the perfect egg. What's your explanation of how to make a perfect egg?
Oh, I've gone through many different methods over the years, and I now think it is better to put it. I used to think that you could put it into cold water and bring it to the boil and then time it from then. But now I just think it's just there's too much uncertainty over when you really do reach simmering point. So now I lower it into boiling water and then time it from that point onwards. But I can't pretend that my boiled eggs are always perfect, because there's just always something that can go wrong, isn't there? There are just too many variables in cooking. It's not really a scientific exercise, but then that's the joy of it, because it's so wonderful when it does go right.
Talking with Bea Wilson, food writer, historian, and author of Consider the Fork, a history of how we cook and eat. Quickly now, where do you stand on the microwave oven? Yay or nay?
Mixed feelings, but yay.
All right. And what are you making today? What are you cooking today?
Oh, I am going home, and I'm going to make some fresh pasta with my children. They've just really got into making pasta by hand with a pasta machine. It's kind of like Play-Doh.
With the crank machine?
With the crank machine, yeah.
I love that. Do you do the wide ones or do you do the angel hair?
I never do angel hair because I'm not that deft, but probably somewhere in between. Not the really wide pappardelle, but more like sort of fettuccine kind of thing.
Oh, we'd love to come for dinner.
I'd wish you could if I wasn't in England. That'd be great.
Bea Wilson, food writer, historian, and author of Consider the Fork, a history of how we cook and eat. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
We always want to hear from you. You're debating, you're talking, you're a part of our conversations. Linda from Miami weighed in on the issue of affirmative action we debated earlier on the program.
My son goes to school with Latinos and he goes to school with blacks, and they're all raised the same. We live in the same neighborhood. When they go to college, why should they be given a preference on a case-by-case basis? Of course, affirmative action is necessary, but not as a broad stroke for everyone.
You know how to reach us. Weigh in on the debate at 8778-MY-TAKE. Post to our site, thetakeaway.org. If you want to catch up on that conversation, anything else on the program, you can get our podcast, re-listen on demand, share segments with your friends, continue the debate at home. That's on our site, thetakeaway.org. On the program tomorrow, in honor of International Day of the Girl, we'll be following up on the topic of girls' education with a 22-year-old young woman from Afghanistan who's opened a school for girls there. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Funding for Detroit coverage of The Takeaway is supported in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, WKKF.org. The Takeaway is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.